It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a pediatrician answers your questions about the COVID vaccines for infants and kids under five. First, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its fourth hearing yesterday. The group focused on how former President Trump pressured state and local officials to reject the results of the 2020 election and in some cases submit unofficial slates of pro-Trump electors in states that had been won by Joe Biden. One piece of new evidence yesterday involves Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Text messages show Johnson's staff asked the vice president's team on January 6th if he could hand over a list of alternate electors for Michigan and Wisconsin. Vice President Pence's staff refused. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's covered this and is here to get us caught up. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you remind us of what these false slates of electors were and why we had one here in Wisconsin?
Well, this was part of a legal strategy at first by the Trump campaign. Some of the electors had said that the idea was, as court challenges, seeking, like in Wisconsin, to throw out certain amounts of absentee ballots or what have you, as those were working their way through the courts, the idea was that having these alternate electors would help, if the cases were won, then they would be, they could be submitted to Congress and potentially be chosen in lieu of the Democratic elector votes for Joe Biden. So this was in multiple swing states. Wisconsin was one of them. And that's essentially what I understand about the process.
The court cases didn't overturn those election results, but those documents signed by electors didn't go away, at least according to this exchange. Can you remind us what this exchange between a Senator Johnson staff or his chief of staff as of that day and the vice president's staff? What did we learn in this exchange?
So there was a screenshot presented by the committee during the hearing, and it really jumped out at me. I'm looking for a Wisconsin connection to all of this, knowing that we had these alternate electors or fake electors as the committee has described them. But essentially, Johnson's chief of staff, Chris Hodgson, reached out, I'm sorry, Senate Sean Riley, mm-hmm. Johnson's chief of staff, reached out to Chris Hodgson, who's an aide for Mike Pence. And this was like right before the attack on the Capitol and right before the electors were going to be certified by Congress and by Pence. And Riley basically asked, he said, Johnson needs to hand something to V. POTUS. And when Hodgson asked what it was, Riley responded, alternate slate of electors from Michigan and Wisconsin, because archivist didn't receive them. The archivist that he's talking about is the, the National Archives, which they were also sent to. And Pence's aide Hodgson told him, do not give that to him. So it makes it look like Senator Johnson was willing to hand those to Mike Pence, right before the actual certification process was about to begin.
Johnson's office responded saying it's not a story, basically. Reporters talked to Senator Johnson outside the Capitol yesterday, asked him about it. Here's a listen to that exchange with Manu Raju of CNN.
This was a staff-to-staff exchange, and I was, basically unaware of it. And the chief staff contacted the vice president's staff, said, do you want this? They said no, and we didn't deliver it, and that's the end of the story.
But why was he even asking for that?
Because somebody delivered this to our office and asked to deliver that to the vice president.
Did you support his efforts to try to get those slates to the vice president?
No, I had no knowledge of this.
So what questions are people still trying to resolve here, Rich, about this situation?
Well, there are still questions about whether Senator Johnson was involved with it or not, because the text seems to indicate that Johnson indicated he wanted to hand this to the vice president. So that's one question. There's a lot of questions about who, dropped this manila envelope off at the senator's office. Some folks are implying that Johnson was involved with receiving them as well. Like, he was knowledgeable. And then also there, some of the other testimony and documents that were revealed by the committee yesterday showed that if people with Trump's campaign were asking some of these alternate electors in Wisconsin to fly this over, you know, on the on January 4th, just a couple days before the certification was set to go down. And so there was a concerted effort, and who brought the the slate of alternate electors and the votes and all the documents to Johnson's office, or whether he brought them himself, you know, it's unknown.
Rich, we'll keep watching for coverage on this. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter. He talked to us about news from yesterday's Congressional House hearing that Senator Ron Johnson's staff asked to pass a slate of false presidential electors to the vice president on January 6th, 2021. Now, earlier this month, an engineer at Google went public with concerns he raised about one of the company's language models starting to think it was alive. The company looked into his claims and dismissed them and ultimately placed him on administrative leave. Other computer science experts have reviewed the transcripts and agreed the model is not sentient, but it is leading the industry to have wider conversations about the morals and ethics of technology that might border someday on consciousness, as well as algorithms that affect our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about artificial intelligence? Have you heard about this story, about this Google engineer raising these concerns? What do you think? Where do you draw the line between a computer program and a living thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John Basil is an associate professor of philosophy at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. He's the associate director in charge of AI and data ethics initiatives at the Northeastern University Ethics Institute. He earned his PhD at UW-Madison. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start with this story. People may have seen it in the news. Initially, some people maybe got excited or worried. What do you make of this claim from this Google engineer?
Like Google and many other people, I think it pretty implausible that this particular technology is sentient, if we mean by that something like conscious or capable of feelings or understanding or having a sort of inner mental life. Maybe it's intelligent in some sense. That's a pretty broad term, but I think it pretty unlikely that it meets the bar for sentience.
Let's talk about a few terms here. Artificial intelligence, we go to a lot. I think it might mean different things to different people. How do you broad strokes define it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I don't think there's a single definition that's accepted. People use it in different ways, but broadly it means artificial systems that can engage in behavior that we recognize as intelligent in some sense. It can solve a problem in a way that we broadly see as intelligent or human. And that means lots of different things, because there's lots of different kinds of intelligences that we recognize. Most of today's artificial intelligence comes in the form of machine learning, which is algorithms that are trained on lots and lots of data, and so they can accomplish really intelligent tasks on the basis of that training.
And a lot of these machine learning things do things that are meant to resemble creativity, art, or writing something, or in this Google engineer's case, having a conversation with a human. Can you talk about how that works if I'm sitting down and maybe having a typed conversation with this machine learning thing that talks a little like people?
Yeah, sure. So imagine that the way I train this algorithm is I just gave it tons and tons of text. So it's read Shakespeare and Jane Austen and science journals and what people have said on the internet, and it's learned when people say things like, hi, how are you doing? It should reply from some list of things like, oh, I'm good, how are you? Or something like that. And so if you train it on enough data, it can get pretty good at having a conversation with you. I mean, this kind of programming has been going on for a long time. There's a famous thing called the Turing test. Alan Turing sort of thought the way to understand intelligence was if you could have someone have a conversation with someone behind a screen and they couldn't tell whether it was a computer or a human, then that's the Turing test. That would count as intelligent. And we're getting closer and closer, or it seems, to things that can pass that kind of test, where you could have a conversation with them and you might not be able to tell that you're talking to a machine. Now, most instances we can tell, you get on a chatbot online to get some help for some services you have, or some, you go on a cancel service and you're talking to a chatbot and you can tell that it's not quite human. But we're getting further and further along, and Lambda seems to be like that.
Lambda is the Google product we're talking about here. Now, if we're trying to define artificial intelligence as having some kind of, I don't know, consciousness or self-awareness. It seems like part of the problem is we don't necessarily know how to define that for a biological creature like a human.
Yeah, we have a real difficult time saying exactly what it is. Like, we know what it is because it's happening to us all the time. And we also have a real hard time figuring out what the basis for it is. Like, what can a system made of silicon even have that kind of state? Like, this is a serious debate at the sort of foundations of philosophy and cognitive science about what grounds consciousness. Like, what exactly can give rise to this thing that we can barely describe?
We're talking to Northeastern University philosophy professor John Basil about the morals and ethics of artificial intelligence and algorithms that affect our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your hopes for artificial intelligence? Do you have questions? Do you have concerns about it? And how about these big data things that might affect a lot of decisions in our lives, like whether we get a mortgage, a job, a prison sentence? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with John Basil, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Northeastern University, with us today to talk about the prospect of sentient artificial intelligence and how it would fit into our moral and ethical systems. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question, a thought about artificial intelligence, what it is, do you have worries about what it could mean for us humans and about how we treat it if and when we have an artificial intelligence that we agree, yeah, is somehow equivalent to a form of consciousness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John, part of the reason, as I understand it, that this Google engineer brought up these concerns about Lambda is he was worried not about how an artificial intelligence will treat humans, but about how we treat it. What are the ethics? What are our responsibilities to something like this that we've created? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is the part, while I don't think that this system rose to the level of sentience, right, I do think we are ill prepared for that possibility. We don't have the greatest track record of treating individuals of other species well. It took a long time, for example, to get oversight boards to govern animal subjects research to make sure animals weren't being harmed unnecessarily. And the real risk, I think, is given that we have a hard time saying what consciousness is and how it arises, there's a real risk that if we created a sentient AI, we might not be able to tell that we've done so. We might not be able to figure out what would be good or bad for it. We might be totally ignoring what would make its life go well or poorly, or make it suffer or benefit. Might just shut it off. And so I think that there, given the hype there is behind AI, there's a real risk that we don't have measures in place to ensure that we avoid unethical treatment if that thing were to arise. Now, when will that arise? I don't know, but we're not well prepared for that circumstance.
Now, that's a hypothetical that we're not prepared for. Another issue I know you're concerned about is something that is here and happening now, the use of big data and algorithms to crunch through that data to figure out a lot of stuff that affects our lives. I mentioned a few moments ago that might include getting a mortgage or a job or determine a prison sentence in part. What kind of concerns do you have about the way those tools are used?
Oh man, we only have like 10 minutes, right? it's a serious problem for a number of reasons. There's concerns about fairness, that these algorithmic decision-making systems, they encode bias in the data. Our bias is data. Our data is biased. They learn that bias, but then they spit out what seem like objective measures. So we're not even sensitized often in to the ways that they're biased. There's also different kinds of privacy concerns that arise with these technologies than with typical technologies. On the basis of what seems like pretty mundane data, they can make really invasive inferences about us. So we have to rethink what privacy is and how to respect privacy in the face of these big data analytics tools. There's problems of transparency. We can't always understand exactly, not for reasons of like patents or copyrights, but we really can't figure out how these systems make the decisions they're making. So how do we figure out what's going on inside them? And does it matter when we can't? That's just three: transparency, privacy, and fairness. There are many more. One of the things I often say is that like, we just don't yet have an ethics ecosystem or an ethics infrastructure for managing these problems. We're trying to build them, but the technology is moving really fast.
Whose job is it to build that ethical ecosystem to make those qualities, the transparency and privacy, front and center?
Yeah, one of the challenges is that the answer is all of us. We need sensitive regulation, because that's going to motivate a lot of people to take this seriously. But as in all areas, regulation is just one piece of managing ethics. Like, compliance is sort of the floor for ethics. And then there's, what else can we do? We need companies to better understand the ethical problems. We need ethicists like me to understand the technologies better, so that when we, so we don't just trot out old solutions that are really useful for technologies that we in the past, but they're not useful in this context. Like, privacy protections that we developed for traditional technologies or for medical records are not as useful in the context of big data analytics. So there's as a distributed responsibility, which is another one of the problems, because it's much easier to turn out technologies that do very cool things, but also have really bad consequences, than it is to build this infrastructure.
Can you give us a, for instance, of how big data is being used and then plugged into algorithms, for better or worse, in ways that might affect us?
Yeah, I think the most famous example is probably the Compass recidivism prediction tool. This is a tool that is trained on lots of data and provides risk scores for people it's been used for pretrial detention. So determining whether a given individual should be held without bail or held prior to trial based on their risk score, based on past information that has been trained into the system. And so one of the things that people worry about, for good reason, is, do these systems disproportionately negatively impact Black arrestees? Do they get higher risk scores on average than white arrestees? And what does that mean for sort of issues of distributive and procedural fairness?
Talking to John Basil, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Northeastern University, looking at the ethics surrounding artificial intelligence and things that might look like it, algorithms that use big data to make decisions that affect us. We had a caller call in, John, who wanted to reference 2001, A Space Odyssey, famously an artificial intelligence gone awry a little bit. Like, how much of our thinking about this is shaped and maybe sent in the wrong direction by all the science fiction that we've had leading up to today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think sometimes it's misleading, but sometimes it really paints a picture that can help us sort of better conceptualize the ethical challenges. Now, the thing about Space Odyssey is it's made very clear to us that this thing is a villain. It's not so clear that it's sentient or conscious, but we know it's the bad guy. But I think they really do. I mean, most of the cases where we have these sci-fi issues about sentient AI, they really do force us to think about the key question, like, is it really sentient? Like, my favorite example is WALL-E. There's a Pixar movie, because you really feel a lot of sympathy for WALL-E, but is WALL-E sentient? Is WALL-E sad that he can't be with Eva? I think that's the name of the other robot. Mm-hmm. So, like, they really raise these questions, what philosophers would call epistemological questions, of how can we come to know that these things have an inner life, that they're conscious, that they're self-aware?
I want to talk about the garbage in, garbage out part of this. You mentioned how algorithms can reinforce our biases. Some of these machine learning things, as you mentioned, trawl the internet looking for examples for their reactions, their responses. There's a lot of horrible stuff on the internet. There's a lot of great stuff in the internet. There's a lot of fact and a lot of fiction on the internet. How do we make sure that our inputs, whether we're talking about an algorithm or a machine learning tool or a hypothetical sentient AI of the future, how do we control to make sure that the inputs it's getting are useful?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are lots of computer scientists working on how to solve this problem. There's a lot of work already done being able to identify the ways in which, even when we try our best to keep the garbage out, it gets in. But I think one of the things we want to think about is the problem is not just about managing the data, because a lot of the data that's going to make for useful applications, we can't control. So we got to think of these things as a holistic process, that these are tools, that they integrate into socio-technical decision-making systems. And we can also think about how to mitigate the bias at the other end by making sure we keep humans as part of the process, by making sure they understand the tools they're using, so they recognize the ways in which they're biased, so they can respond in a way that sort of mitigates against the bias. So it's not just about keeping the garbage out, because if we have to keep all the garbage out, then we lose out on a lot of the benefits of the algorithms. Although sometimes we might think, no, you can only use pristine data. The problem is that even when the data is, when we try to keep the data really pristine, we end up with the same kinds of problems.
Now, you're looking at these cutting edge questions. Again, some of these are hypotheticals that aren't even here yet, from the lens of philosophy and traditions that go back literally thousands of years. Are you able to take what you look at in AI and bring it back and maybe talk to your students about the things they might be learning in their 101 classes and tie those together?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's never been easier to explain why some of the fundamental issues in philosophy matter for practical things, because the promises that people in the AI space make often just are point us directly back at these thousand-year-old questions. So there's a lot to learn from the current context about sort of fundamental ideas. Or they motivate thinking about these deeper issues. But also we face a fun challenge the other way. It's a difficult challenge, but it's fun. Is like the tools we developed for 2,000 years. These, how do we apply them to these tools? And like, how do the nuances of, for example, artificial intelligence and machine learning make us rethink or make us adapt the tools we've been developing for other contexts? So yeah, my classrooms are full of talking about the near future, the far future, and how it connects with the distant past, at least within philosophy.
And briefly, what are you most interested in that near future horizon?
Yeah, in the near future, I'm mostly thinking currently about issues of governance. How do we build structures? How do we bring the right people in the room to sort of solve these problems across the system? So how do we build that ethics ecosystem to really take on these problems?
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Basil is an associate professor of philosophy and associate director in charge of AI and data ethics initiatives at the Northeastern University Ethics Institute. He was with us today to discuss issues of morals and ethics around artificial intelligence and other cutting-edge computer technology. This after a Google engineer claimed that one of the tools that he works with had achieved some form of sentience. Google and most people in this line of work say probably not yet, but it raises a lot of interesting questions. Coming up after the news, a pediatrician explains what we need to know about the COVID vaccine for infants and kids under 5, hoping you'll join in with your questions and your decision-making process along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.